Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, and I talk to entrepreneurs for a very long time before they say yes to interviews. Joining me is an entrepreneur who I guess we had a conversation a while back, and then I get an email from him out of the blue about a month ago where he says, "Andrew, I'm finally ready to tell my story." And I thought, okay, great. I wonder why he was hesitating. Then he follows up with me and he tells me what happened. I go, "Holy, is he really going to say all this online?" And he's smiling. Apparently he is. Joining me is Martin Martinez. I know him as the founder of Alfred. And what Alfred does is it basically lets you market to people on LinkedIn. It both lets you say, if you have, like I do, I have thousands of people who are connected to me on LinkedIn, I could pull in their email addresses and then bucket them. And if I wanted just CEOs who are here in San Francisco, Alfred allows me to send email to them, just to the CEOs in San Francisco. If I want to expand my network beyond and say, I want to know every founder in San Francisco, they will allow me to find all those founders, add them on LinkedIn, and then send them messages. And then if they do add me on LinkedIn, I could follow up with them both in InMail, which is LinkedIn's email system, or with regular email. And apparently coming now, I could also tweet at them. Basically, robust communication and marketing tools within LinkedIn. That's what Alfred is. I knew that. That was amazing on its own because it's kind of a gutsy thing to do. You're basically saying LinkedIn wants to control communication between its members. And Martin says, I'm going to let people decide how they're going to communicate with people on LinkedIn. So it got him into a little bit of trouble with LinkedIn, but he's found a way out of it. But then I read his backstory. The poker, the debt, the whole thing. I want to find out about all of it. Some of it maybe is illegal. We'll find out within this interview. This interview is sponsored by two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you're hiring a developer, you already know, and I'll keep repeating it because I know that you're going to thank me for telling you about them. You should be going to toptal.com/Mixergy. And the second, if you have a team of people and you want to make sure that they're all working like your best person, you need the right online manual, you need the right online training system, and there's a software called Trainual that I'm going to convince you later on that you should sign up for. But first, Martin, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to know about the poker that happened in your house. You were how deep in debt before you did this?
Well, you know, life gives you a couple of knocks. And by the time that I started playing, hosting poker games at my house, I was minus $40,000.
$40,000 in debt. Sleeping well with that or freaking out?
No, you don't sleep with. I mean, I had a normal job. I worked in a casino, you know, and when you actually work in a casino, it's kind of interesting. You lose understanding of what money is because people come in with thousands, if not millions, and you think, oh, this is normal. And you get, you know, $800 a week or whatever your wage is, and you blow it, you know, gambling as well. I wasn't a gambler, but, you know, it just, you know, life gives you a couple of knocks and sets you back. And at that time, I got in pretty deep at 40,000.
We're going to get into the knocks and how you got deep in debt and then also how you climbed out. But the idea that you had was hosting poker games at your house for who?
Well, for my workmates. So we all work in a casino. We're all loving gambling. We often took trips to different places to gamble. And what better place to do it than, you know, a 15-minute walk from the casino at a mate's house? And that's kind of where it all started. I had to find a way to, you know, get out of debt, but I couldn't just quit. And I also couldn't do anything illegal. Otherwise, I would lose my casino license because I worked in the Sydney casino. So it was just one of those things that my friends... actually, other people were hosting games and they stopped. So there was a demand for it. And I said, okay, let's start doing it. And I would have a fully hosted game. So we tear down my living room, put a poker table, empty the fridge, order the pizzas. It was fully catered and they loved it.
How much money were people betting?
We started relatively small. It was like $1-$2, you know, okay. You know, ante and bets, and but it was no limit poker. So, you know, the pots could get pretty high pretty quick. You know, we at one point actually had to put some responsible gambling policies where if you lost all your money, you had to take a break for an hour because people would just, you know, borrow and buy in again. Like it got crazy. But it was friends, so you got to control it. You know, it wasn't nice to see all your friends losing all their money.
How did you make money from this?
So I played. I was a dealer. Nobody dealt but me. So I played as well as dealt. And I also took a 5% commission. So that part of it is the illegal part.
That means off of every game?
Every pot.
How does it work? Every pot? Every pot before the winner takes it, you take 5% into your pile.
Correct.
And so
if it's a $100 pot, I take $5, put it in my pocket, give the 95 out, and then you keep on scraping the pot as it goes.
Was it awkward to just take money off of your friend's pot and put it into your pile? No.
Well, it's fully catered. You know, you come in, you drink beer, you drink alcohol, you drink whatever you want. You eat as much as you want. You had everything taken care of. You had cable TV. It was like a mini casino, but it was in a one-bedroom apartment. They don't mind. It was part of the game.
I read a great book by a woman who did something similar. It's called Molly's Game. I like the book so much more than the movie. But one of the things that I learned from her was she didn't want a rake because once you take money off the table, then it's illegal. Otherwise, it's just a house game. The government seems okay with it. And so what she would get is, I think she would just be given gifts from people. You were just straight up taking a rake. Weren't you worried about that being illegal considering that you're working in a casino at the time?
Being a home game, if you looked at the legislation, which I did, because I worked in a casino, so I had to look into it. It was kind of ambiguous, so we just ran with it. And actually, casino management played in my game, so they were part of culprits as well as everybody else, so they knew what was going on.
All right, fair enough. Let's get into your story. I should also say, Alfred hit a milestone revenue-wise. I hope you're going to talk about that. There's so much to cover in Alfred alone, but I want to go a little bit further back. You're from Uruguay. My wife and I used to have to go to Uruguay when we lived in Argentina because we were not Argentine citizens and we had to leave the country every few months. We just take a trip to Uruguay. Let's just go there. Let's just go to Chile. I didn't feel like I got a sense of Uruguay, but from what I saw, it seemed like a good country that was fairly easy to live in. Why did your family want to leave Uruguay in the 70s?
Right. Well, you know, I actually was 1 month old and I left Uruguay. So I'm a tourist just like you
why?
Are.
Why? Yeah. Why did you guys leave it?
Look, it was you know, my family, like most, there's more Uruguayans outside of Uruguay than there are inside of Uruguay. So it's just one of the countries that is so small, doesn't have huge opportunities, very agricultural driven. So business opportunities or, you know, work opportunities weren't there. So my father decided to follow my uncle who had moved to Barcelona, Spain. Mm-hmm. And he helped him out to move over. And then, you know, it was kind of that one of those things that just traveling and moving for better opportunities.
And I guess also I'm experiencing Uruguay as somebody who is living in an internet connected world where it doesn't matter where I live. I get to live nicely in Uruguay, but I get opportunities for business from the rest of the world. That wasn't true then. All right. So why did you end up traveling so much afterwards before you settled down in Australia?
Yeah, you're going to have to ask my dad about that because by the time I was 14, so 1 month old, I moved from Uruguay to Spain. And from there, we moved and moved and moved. By the time I was 14, when we arrived in Australia, I had moved 27 different places and 7 different schools.
You didn't ask your dad, so why are we moving?
Well, they were just looking for opportunities. And, you know, I don't know if my dad
is. I don't know. I got to tell you, Martin, 27 times, that seems like maybe he's getting away from something, no?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I should ask my dad. You know,
I got to interview him.
But no, it was more ambition. It was more ambition. He was trying to better himself and better the family and the situation. He comes from a rural part of Uruguay. So, you know, they don't have anything there where he was going. He was trying to get better and better. So it was more about opportunities coming up. Moving for those and so on and so forth. That was my childhood, unfortunately. It was a gypsy lifestyle.
And you were doing things like importing wines from Spain, doing all kinds of things, looking for opportunities, like what we call today a hustler, someone who's hustling for business. All right, got it. You then ended up getting a job at a bank, lasted only 6 months while you were watching multi-million dollar transactions because you saw this guy who was working there for 20 years. What happened with him?
Right. So I started, you know, I was interested in international business and we did a little bit of the wine thing that you were saying. And I thought, okay, banking could be an interesting area. I got a job as a, you know, entry level employee in the international operations. And I was handling multi-million dollar transactions and I was getting paid like at the time, it was probably $300 a week. So I'm thinking like, there's a lot of responsibility on me for this managing these transactions. Yet, you know, it didn't didn't seem right. But then on top of that, one employee would choose his 20th year anniversary. They literally stopped everybody, congratulated him, gave him a cake and a pen after 20 years.
Yeah.
And then he went back to work 5 minutes later. So I thought, this is not right. This is not going to work for me. So I kind of had to leave. And I actually went to help my parents manage what was a failing French patisserie business.
How did you do? What did you do there and how did it go?
The thing is, my dad is very passionate. So it's all about quality. He even won awards for his croissants in Australia and so on and so forth. But, you know, he didn't look at the numbers very well. Now, I was very young. I was still really early 20s. So I just came in and I looked at it from fresh eyes. And then I said, well, we were literally in bankruptcy at that point. So my job was let's pause all debt, everything that's owed. And then we only pay rent. That's our priority and everything comes thereafter. So I negotiated with all the vendors, you know, and then with the little money that was coming in, we were able to take care of the rent, take care of all the other vendors, but most importantly, renew our lease. And instead of selling the business, what I did is actually sold the lease because it was a prime place in Bondi, which is one of the number one beaches here in Australia, or the number one beach in Australia. So it was prime real estate, and us holding a 5-year lease, we could sell the lease and then get out of, you know, the whole debt. And that's kind of how I got them out of a jam.
Ah, got it. Yeah, Bondi Beach is beautiful. It's kind of a richy area, right? Full of people in their 20s who are getting to live life on their own for the first time.
Correct.
All right. That had to fill you with confidence, right? Because you found a way out of it.
Well, it gave me an insight of business because up until then I was just working as an employee, you know, managing money and being frugal. But it also gave me a perspective of the opportunity. If you do the work, you get more compensation than if you're actually working on an hourly rate. So, you know, it was an insight. It didn't kind of say, oh, you're an entrepreneur now, but it kind of gave me an insight of the possibilities.
All right. You then decide, I'm going to go get another job. Why not do this, start another business? Why not help other people? Why? You just don't see yourself as an entrepreneur, or you didn't, it seems like.
Well, the thing is, you know, once bitten, twice shy. So when you see your parents going almost bankrupt, in running their own business, you think twice about, you know, investing your whatever little dollars you got into running a business. So I kind of took a safe route out and I was actually looking to become a flight attendant, but nobody was hiring at the time. I was looking to work for Qantas or Emirates. And then I got into the casino business. I was one of the first employees in the new Sydney Harbour Casino. And it was kind of, you know, just got a job until I saw something else. And then once I got into that, the casino industry, I saw a career path and an easy career path.
Well, what's just a career kind of a path? If you're dealing, well, where does it end?
Right. Well, unlike in America where you take tips and croupiers or dealers stay there forever because they take the you know, they're giving tips and stuff. We don't have tips in Australia. So in our case, what we did is, you know, you start as a dealer, but you progress as a supervisor, or first you learn more games. Once you learn enough games, you go to the supervisor, then you go to pit boss, and from there to shift manager and then casino manager and so on. So it was a pretty linear and clear, and you could see other people because the industry was growing. I thought, okay, well, this is going to be much better than working in an airline. So I kind of stuck it out.
Okay. How did you end up in debt?
Well, you know, I lived on my own. So, you know, you go to furnish your place, you borrow a couple of dollars to do that. I never liked living with anybody else. So it was kind of, you know, I had to pay high rent because Sydney's expensive, as you probably know. So it was just one thing after another. I had an accident, busted a tooth. It cost me 10 grand to get an implant. You know, it was just kind of those things. And so I ended up getting into debt to about 30 grand.
Okay.
And then what I had an epiphany, right? I said to my girlfriend, let's go to the most luxurious holiday we could ever imagine. And I was $30,000 down. So I ended up finding a place. It's a private island out in Malaysia called Pangkor Laut, $500 a night, you know, 15 years ago. So it was pretty hefty with bungalows over the water and stuff like that. So we decided to take a trip and it was all on credit. So by the time, and the whole purpose of that is to really, you know, feel something positive. It was like, you know, when you're down, you're negative. Like, I just wanted to go somewhere and live the kind of life that I want to live, yeah. which is a luxurious life, comfortable life.
Yeah.
So we ended up going there. We ended up going for Christmas and spent New Year's in Kuala Lumpur. And it was amazing. It was unforgettable. And then when I came back, I was minus $40,000. And it was just the new year. And I said, like, I got to get out of this, you know. And I hustled. Like you said, it's all about hustle. So that's kind of what I did.
And that's where the home game came in. Do you Correct. Feel that going away on your trip helped you get your head on right so you could do that?
It put, you know, one of the things that I think I'm good at is reacting well under pressure. And when your back is against the wall, your number's called and you know, you need to do something. So you either put your hands up or you get into the grind. So I feel like that's happened to me twice, and we'll probably get into that story later. But that's what happened to me then. It's like my back is, I don't know how to quit, and I'm a sore loser. So for me, losing 40,000 going back to Lee was just not an option. So I had to hustle it out. So the trip gave me a time to not think negatively and think positively. And I didn't come up with an epiphany while I was on holidays. It was just a great experience. But when I came back, I had my mind clear that I needed to do something. I didn't know quite what was going to happen, but I ended up doing the home games.
You know, Martin, I'm the same way. And I need to recognize that more in myself, that when I'm in an inspiring place, it does push me to bring out my best work. I know for some people, well, I'll give you an example. When I graduated from school, I bought myself a nice Audi and I bought myself a house when I couldn't afford anything. I shouldn't have bought an Audi. But it inspired me to say, this is the life you deserve. This is the life you're claiming. You're going to fight for this. And I somehow knew that I would be able to do it. I think for some people, that would just spiral into wasted money and they'd be disappointed that they'd done it. It would be an absolute mistake. I don't know how to say it, but for me, it's a positive and I need to keep doing that. And it sounds like that's
what
happened.
I'll back you up on that. I'll back you up one step further. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I experienced experiencing in the casino is that I was always in the VIP room, in the high mm-hmm. rollers room. So I was always exposed to what, I don't know where these people made the money, but they came in with millions. So I'm thinking, mm-hmm. what the hell are these people doing? And I want to learn right. from that. When I went on that holiday, it was a private island. You couldn't be in there unless you were a guest. And I saw families with their nannies traveling mm-hmm. with them. Like, I'm thinking, okay, this is possible. I saw helicopters landing, you know, like, this is possible. This is what I want to. And for me, if you aim at something that's potentially unattainable, if you get halfway there, you're going to be doing all right. So that was kind of my driving force.
You know what? On the lower end, there was a school teacher, I think she was in New York, Marva Collins. She was so popular, there was a TV show made about her because she would take people who are underprivileged and turn their lives around. And one of the things that I heard her say that she did was she would take these kids who'd never been to a nice restaurant before and take them to a nice restaurant and sit them down there. She said, if I could show them a taste of what's possible, make them feel that this is a place that they could be in, that they would aspire to return and they would feel worthy of that kind of success. And so we're talking a small thing. For them, it's a restaurant. For you, it's a place with helicopters. For me, when I was graduating, it was that Audi. But I do completely believe that that is true. And I could see that that was a responsible decision. I've learned a lot actually from just tapping into your experience with that about myself. You then turn things around financially with your poker game. You had this site called highrollersnetwork.com, which was?
It was an affiliate site for online casinos. So as I said, I was working in the casino space. I actually, you know, was only exposed to high rollers. So I thought, you know, and I am I'm a kind of a techie. So I thought I can put two and two together. And I launched an affiliate site. So I contacted all of the premium online casinos, told them that's my pitch. That's my angle. That's the people that I want to appeal to. So can we create, you know, better services, better bonuses, better everything for those type of clients that would come in at a higher, you know, price point or a higher deposit rate. And the logic behind it for me was not only the commission that I would make, but also if I'm appealing to a larger customer, I don't need as many customers to make a good living. So there was a two-sided kind of idea behind it, but it ended up flopping. It was too early for its time.
But it seems like, well, from what I'm understanding, you're saying it's a link site where you're linking out to online casinos and you're getting a commission, but there was Correct. Nothing for people to do outside of going to get to link out. And yes, they could, well, right. Except you've got these promotions where they could win baseball cups and coffee mugs and mouse pads and so on, right?
Yeah, we had promotions, we had bonus structures that you couldn't get anywhere else. So I negotiated things that if you went directly with the casino online, you couldn't get yourself. So you had to become a member, which was free, but you then had access to those benefits, but it also required you to have larger deposits. So you had to pre-qualify by the amount of money you will gamble.
Got it. And so there was a way for people to come to your site and get, for example, $1,000 at Casino Atlantis. Got it. Correct. And on the smaller end is the coffee mug and the mouse pad and so on. Got it. But correct. You were saying, if I could get the top people in, casinos would want them and they'd be willing to give them a big deal for coming in and I would get an affiliate. It seems like the big challenge with this is that there's not a reason for people to come to your site. And that's why it didn't work out. Am I right?
No, it was just, you know, online gambling is huge, but at the time, high rollers wasn't huge. So it was, I think, premature. It was probably, I would say, even 5 years premature. The idea would probably work today, but it didn't work at the time.
Okay, fair enough. I'm looking at a version of the site from 2003. Okay, but you didn't lose much money on that, if anything, right? That's just your first attempt.
It's my first real attempt to launch a business. It failed, but it gave me encouragement that, you know, I learned from it. You know, and I don't treat failures as failures. I treat them as learning experiences.
Yep.
And I learned a lot from that. And, you know, I was pretty frugal with my money because I didn't have much of it. So it was just an opportunity that I took and it didn't work out. That's it. Move on.
All right. I should tell people that my first sponsor is a company called TopTal. Anyone who's listening to this interview, and as we progress, you're going to come up with an idea for a business. You're going to come up with an idea, for software, maybe something that your team doesn't have time to develop. You should know if you go to toptal.com/mixergy, you will get some of the best developers available. They will match you up with them and they stand by their developers. So they have a 2-week no risk trial period. If you want to get started, just go to toptal.com/mixergy to get that 2-week trial period. You'll also get 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. Basically, I'm giving you a lot of reasons to go, if you're hiring developers, to go to toptal.com/mixergy. And I promise you, as this interview continues, you're going to come up with a bunch of ideas that your business should be jumping on. You won't have the development team there to do it. Hire from TopTal. They'll get you started. Top is on top of your head. Tal is in talent. TOPTAL.com/MIXERGY. All right. So you had your taste of online. You had your taste of success offline. But what you were doing was, let's say, not technically legal. So this house game, you were trying to think of, how can I make it into something that was legal? What are some of the thoughts that you had that would allow you to make it into a long-term business?
Right. So technically the game wasn't legal, but, you know, since, as I said, the casino management will come to these games and they became so popular that I kind of lost the fear. The business model around that is that I would take 5% of every pot. So if there's $100 in the pot, I take 5%, then I give it to the winner. And that covered all the costs, you know, all the food and alcohol and whatnot. When I moved away from that, I was looking at different ways, rake, no rake, which is the commission side. And, you know, there's a lot of different models that have been come up with, and I can't remember them all. But I struck luck with the idea of not charging anything and making the entire game free of charge, which is essentially what's called a free roll. The moment, and I was dealing with legislation because I worked in the casino, I knew what the ins and outs of the law, I knew what was going on. So the moment that I came up with the idea of there is no risk whatsoever because the game is 100% for free, and I presented that to the government as a submission, they took this time longer than any other time of every other idea that I had. They actually took several weeks to reply to me, and I thought, what the hell's going on? They came back to me and they said, this is 100% legal. And the reason why is because the moment that you take the gambling side, the moment that legislation didn't apply. So I went from having a home game that took 5% commission to a free game that would, you know, how the hell do I make money? And the idea behind that was that in Australia, there's a lot of pubs and clubs where a lot of people gather on a regular basis, and they need entertainment. They have trivia nights, they have darts, they have bands, they have all sorts of things. So what I did is I came up with the idea of bringing in a poker league hosted by my people who would roll up the tables, roll up the chips, roll up the cards, and host the poker game and earn points towards this league. And that's kind of where the business kind of rolled out from.
You know, Martin, the only concern that I have with that is it makes a lot of sense. I'd just be worried about so much money being in the game and having somebody come and hold you up.
There is no money.
Oh, it's because they're just playing for chips. Oh, got it. As long as they play for chips, and then it's only the grand prize winner that gets cash, I'm assuming, right?
So we went from having really small games. So for example, our first season, we gave away to the winner of the entire league after a major championship. This lady won to go to the Aussie Millions Poker Tournament in Crown Casino in Melbourne. So that was the only prize.
Got it.
For weeks, you know, and it was for entertainment. You know, they come in, they learn to play. It's no risk. If I lose, who cares? But I'm learning the game.
If I win, I get to go to this bigger poker game. Got it. Or at some point, you eventually did cash prizes. Am I understanding that right?
Well, when at the height of our business, we were giving away $10 million in cash and prizes every year.
Wowee. All right. This makes so much sense. That I think would be even legal here in the U.S. to do. And right? Because there's no cash trading hands.
Right.
They don't even have to pay to enter. Do they have to pay to enter the game?
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. It's kind of like all these quizzos and stuff that bars have here.
Correct.
Got it. Except the only thing that you did was you said, if you get chips, I feel it's more interesting. Trivia is kind of fun because you get to talk with other people much more than you do with poker. But poker is much more interesting because you get your chips and you get to keep going. And of course, you're going to have a drink and then another drink. Got it. And I could see how it goes on all night.
Right.
Makes total sense. And you then said, I'm going to franchise this. How was your franchise model working? Who paid?
Well, the business model was kind of unique. So I franchised the business from day one because we wanted to, it was the kind of business that had a low barrier of entry. You could buy a couple of tables, you could buy a couple of chips and cards, and you're good to go to run a franchise or run a poker league. So what we did is we created the Australian Poker League. So we played on the green and gold colors and, you know, that Australian sportsmanship kind of thing. So I approached people that I work with on a daily basis at the casino and said, hey, I'm coming up with this idea. It's been approved by the government. I'm selling franchises for $15,000. It includes the tables and chips and cards. You have a region. Here are all the pubs and clubs that are in that region. Go sell. We'll take care of the website. We'll take care of everything. And then you go and host the games. And we sold 11 franchises before we even started. So all the money that I had put into the business, we recouped from day one because all the franchises were sold and we continued to reinvest to scale. And yeah, that's how we started.
Before we started, I said, why would anyone pay you a franchise fee? And you said, well, yes, they could go and buy their own tables and sell to local bars. But the upside of working with you is they get to feed into this bigger network and their winners get to go and compete against other people and you get these bigger prizes. Got it. What was the name of the company? I've been trying to find it.
Yeah. So the Australian Poker League is the name of the company. It's still running. The URL is playapl.com. They may have some issues right now because of COVID. So there's not much poker.
Right. I don't know what they're going to do with COVID because it all has, you know what, actually I have to tell you, some of my friends were doing poker online and I just hadn't been able to get into it. The idea of recreating the in-person camaraderie online, it could be via Zoom like this, it could be with just audio, but to just have a group of friends play poker against each other makes total sense.
No, it's a great idea. I was actually talking to somebody who did it with his friends on Zoom. So they would play on the iPad or whatever, the computer, but they would see each other on Zoom just to talk and talk smack and whatnot. But you know, it was kind of difficult. Zoom didn't work out too well for them. So I think they gave up.
I just can't figure out how to schedule with people. But there was poker games here in San Francisco. One of the two reasons why I'm here in San Francisco. One is my wife has a job here. And the second is the conversations that you get into with the people that you meet randomly are just amazing. And so as soon as we went into lockdown, a few people created these online poker games. And I just had not been able to get into one because who can schedule this thing in?
Yeah,
it's a little artificial when it's done remotely. All right. I see how you're building this up. How big did it get revenue-wise for you?
Right. So I turned that business from a basic idea that I created in a one-bedroom apartment. And within 3 years, we had 122 franchises in two countries. And we were turning over combined
$50 million. $50 million. Oh, yeah. Look at this. I see. I guess you did an interview or something back in 2017 where you talked about how you did it. And the headline of this thing is After the Exit, How Martin Martinez Grew a $50 Million a Year Poker Empire and Then Gave It All Up. What happened? It started not with you giving it up, but with one sale first, right?
Right. So we were doing really well. We were the leading company in the market. But as I said, it's a low barrier of entry business. So within 12 months, we had like a dozen competitors. And within 24 months, we had, I don't know, I lost count at 30. So, but we were still the biggest. We were still the largest and we're still the best because of the amount of prizes we were giving away for nothing. We were the first company in the world to host a $1 million free roll, which was an in-person event, completely free to enter, but you had to win your way in. We did that at Luna Park, which is a theme park here in the Sydney Harbour. We built a production company. Like, it was crazy. We were basically the World Poker Tour of the Southern Hemisphere at that time. Just to give you some comparables, a Crown Casino in Melbourne, which is one of the largest casinos in Australia, has at peak 300 tables in operation. Every night we would have at least 1,200 tables in operation, just to give you the sense of scale. Yeah. 250,000 players per month. It was nuts. So everything was going rosy until more and more competitors started, biting at our franchises. So, you know, we were the most expensive. We had to adjust and so on.
But what does it mean that they were biting at your franchises?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
It was a price war because if they were selling to the venue, right? The venue was paying us to host was paying the franchisee to host the game. If somebody undercut the price, well, the venue is going to consider it and consider it seriously because it's a fixed cost to them. So for us, it was kind of that level of competition that started to bite.
Okay.
So yep, we grew. It was all fantastic. You know, trips to Vegas, you know, the works. It was a wonderful experience. But one of the things that I did wrong was that, one, I'm a perfectionist by heart. So for me, it's my way or the highway. I want it done this way. And when you have 122 franchisees, quality control is an issue. And we didn't have the resources. So, it became a challenge to manage that network because it grew so fast. We just didn't have the infrastructure. So that was one challenge. The other challenge was that the competition was fierce and we didn't adjust our business model. So we were getting a lot of requests from franchisees, do this, do that, do the other. And because I was more rigid at the time, I said, no, I think we need to do it this way. Cut a long story short, we were actually producing our own shows. It was just, you know, it was crazy. So we wanted to continue to expand. And for us to have a differentiator, we said, we have our own TV shows. Who's going to play for a league that doesn't have, like, you can play on TV for free. You know what I mean? So we got approached by several companies to buy us out or to invest in us. And then we undertook a VC kind of process in order to get investors in. We ended up in 2008 selling half of the company to Win Television, which is the largest regional television network in Australia. And that gave us not only cash in our pockets, but it gave us a TV contract for a minimum of 3 years. So anything that we produced, you know, would be televised. So you got to think, a free league, you enter into a pub, you play for nothing, you make it all the way to the top, and now you're on TV playing for $1 million. You know what I mean? It's very compelling as a story, and that was kind of what happened. Unfortunately for us, once the deal was consummated, I got my money, there were two things that happened. Number one is that within 3 months of the deal being done, the CEO and CFO of the company, Win Television, got fired. Now, this was a big deal because we're talking about a large TV network in Australia. So it was all in the press and whatever. But every plan we had with them was in the bin because the owner of the company said, whatever they touched, it's tainted. And we don't want to deal with it. So that was one thing. The second thing is, unfortunately, my business partner checked out of the business once he cashed in that first half check, because we had already made plenty of money. So I kind of was left alone. I was sitting there kind of, you know, now only owning 25% of the business. I couldn't control the company, yet I got two token board members from this Win Corp. Now, it was a mess from there on. And I kept on pushing. I was trying to grow it. I was trying to kind of do everything I could, but it started to wear thin. So towards the end, which is 2011, there was a coup by the franchisees against me. I was like a dictator. I admit it today, and I admitted it at the time too, to them. It's my way or the highway. And they said, well, the highway is for you. And they basically ousted me.
What does that
and
mean?
That's kind of what was my...
When they ousted you, what does that mean that they ousted you? They all got together?
It was a vote of no confidence. And when you have 122 franchisees pushing, you know, following your every word and really following your vision, which is what happened from day one, to them telling you to get the hell out of there because you're doing the wrong things, you know, it's a turn for the worst.
I heard you also sold to win for less than you could have to someone else because of everything that they were going to bring to the table, right?
Correct. So
how much?
A deal has never been disclosed, but the valuation at the time, I'm happy to share it. It was $8 million and we sold half the company. But it also have a clause with a programming deal worth $3 million. So the deal only law was about $11 million. And we were able to kind of capitalize that. But, you know, we were looking to turn this $8 million company into a $40 million company.
Right.
Because with television, they wanted to own a league instead of other, you know, like rugby league or soccer or whatever. They wanted to own poker. And that was the deal that we struck. But the CEO and CFO got fired. So that deal went to hell.
All right. You and your co-founder, how did you guys connect? And then what happened to the two of you after the sale?
Yeah. So we were very good friends from work. He was also an employee at the casino. He was actually the one that hosted the poker games before me. So, and when he quit, I took over.
Got it.
We were both very knowledgeable on poker. We had obviously lots of friends that were knowledgeable as well. And I was going to run the league with another friend of mine. But he didn't have any capital to actually help me launch it. So then I went to this other friend and I said, well, let's go into it together. You've got some cash. I've got some cash. Let's put it together. And that's how we'd all start.
All right. And then you eventually sold the last 25%, I think, in 2011, Martin sold out the remaining 25% of the business that he founded in 2005 is what I'm reading.
Yeah.
That was it. For how much at that point? Not because there was nothing left.
Well, I mean, the league was still running, but... I just wanted out. I had worked since 2005 to 2004 to 2011. I worked 24/7. It was 24/7. You don't go from zero to 50 million in 3 years. You don't go from zero to 122 franchisees in 3 years. You know, doing that level of expansion without burning out.
And what happened with you and your girlfriend at the time?
So the girlfriend that I went to Malaysia with,
yeah.
We ended up splitting up. And we split up for about 3 years. Then we got back together. We ended up getting married and whatnot. But, you know, she was happy for me to kind of leave that world because I wanted to
be willing
to
be with you as you were working 24/7 obsessing on this?
No, we had split up prior to me kind of starting this poker league. So it was kind of, went on a holiday, came back. We kind of split up around that time. And then I started doing the poker games at home.
And then 3 years later, you reconnected?
Yeah, 3 or 4 years later, we reconnected. I mean, I never lost my love for her. It was just the wrong time, you know, and I was able to do my thing, you know, grew the business.
It doesn't seem like a life that you could balance a relationship with.
No, you couldn't.
When you were dealing with all these different franchisees, what's your process for getting them all to work the same way and work together? Was it, what was your system?
There was no system. It was my passion.
It was just you calling them up and saying, no, the way we do this is this way. You have to do it that way.
Oh, no. It was the belief in me and the vision. They believe.
What I mean is like, I know when I was doing poker games in my house, I'm kind of anal.
Right.
Very anal. I just would put a checklist together because I knew I was doing poker on a regular basis here. And I didn't want a single thing to be off.
Right.
And so if something sucked,
for sure.
What was it? It was a bunch of checklists, things like that.
We had a pool. I mean, as a franchise, you have to be process driven.
Mm-hmm.
So it was process after process after process, documented training, online training, in person. Like it was mind boggling what you need to do in franchising to be consistent. Having said that, once they're in the field, you know, if they're, you know, in another state, policing that is very hard.
Yeah. But at least you give them some foundation. All right. That kind of feeds into my second sponsor, which is why I was teeing that up, to be honest with you. It's a company called Trainual. The idea behind Trainual is they said, we want to take your best people and duplicate them so that you can have everybody be like your best. And the way to do that is to create a written down, not just necessarily with text, but images and videos and everything, documentation. And that's what Trainual is, a way to easily create a training manual for your team so that you can spread the best ideas to everyone. Here's the beauty of Trainual. Yes, it's easy to create each one of these manuals, so you're actually going to do it. Yes, it's easy to edit, which means that if you make a change, it's not going to be something that you dread going back into the documentation and changing. But anyone who already went through the first process the first time, if there's a change that's significant, you could just go back and say anyone who took this process before, who learned it, who did it before, should know about this new change. There are lots of different features here that will make it easy for anyone who's listening to us, Martin, to have a clear, documented process of working. And it's especially important when you're working with people all over the world, different sensibilities, different working styles, and you want them all on the same page. I'm going to tell anyone who's, by the way, this is not like a paid ad. From what I understand, their ad ran out. Ari has... We said, I'm not selling any more ads this year. And Ari says, all right, I'm just going to take some of the best, the ads that have done well, the ads who we want to do well, the companies that we love, and we're just going to give them a free spot. And so this isn't even a paid ad. We just really like Trainual. So if you're out there listening to me and you want to sign up for it, you can actually use our URL. I was just testing right now to make sure it works. They haven't advertised in a while. But if you go to trainual.com/mixergy, they're going to give you 30% off your first 3 months. Plus, you're going to get our onboarding process that we use to when we hire people, and the interview process. It's automatically going to be dropped into your Trainual account for free. So you see the systems that we use here at Mixergy. So here it is. It's trainual.com/mixergy. By the way,
I wish I had trained you.
You would have loved it. I had to cut back on a lot. You know what? I realized... I wanted this year to be a light year, and I cut back on a lot. And then I noticed that I was married to a lot of things, a lot of things that I just wanted to do because I did them. And it's hard for me to cut back on them. And one of them is advertising. I just want to sell. I love selling. I don't know if you're like this, Martin, but when you sell and somebody buys, I feel like they like me. I feel like I'm validated. I feel like I've got points. I feel like all of that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those insecurities we have that, you know, get confirmed when they pay us.
Yeah. And so I had to say, yes, we will be selling. Let's sell again next year. And then we got this sponsor that's coming up, Gusto. I said that to Gusto, I'm sorry, I can't sell anything. The only thing I'm going to sell this year is we never sold any ads for Christmas, but I think we'll do that as an experiment. She said, I'll take those. I go, wow, I just try not to sell. And you bought anyway. I feel great. Now I love Gusto. Oh, yeah. And now I feel like Gusto loves me. So that's the only new advertiser that we're going to see. Otherwise, Andrew's going to try to take some time to just think and clear my mind this year and to do homeschooling this year, which I've been freaking loving. All right. So this thing worked out. Why is it that you told me you eventually had to sell your house afterwards?
Yeah, this is where the story took a turn. So in 2010, after we got back together with my girlfriend, we got married. And to be honest, from that point on, it was like, it was the kiss of death. And we've talked about this, like from that day we got married, everything kind of turned bad. Not our relationship, but it was just, you know, everything else. So I got ousted out of the business in 2011. And I was kind of pleased with that at the end of it. It wasn't a nice ending. It wasn't a nice way to kind of exit your own business that you've created this baby and this monster. But, you know, it ended and I moved on. And when I close a chapter, I can just isolate it and move on. So
me too.
I was kind of in this honeymoon period with my wife, looking for different ways to make an income. And the unfortunate part for me was that everything that I touched, when you do an exit, and you have millions of dollars and you're not say rich, but you're wealthy enough where you don't have to work. You think your shit doesn't stink and you, whatever you touch is supposed to be gold. Mm-hmm. And it actually was the opposite. Everything that I touched just went sour. Nothing would work. Nothing would take off. And I launched hair salon franchises. I launched an online magazine. I can't even remember. It was 7 or 8 different ventures before the boardroom, which I can get to.
Why hair salon? It seems like these are pretty outside of your focus.
Well, again, when you think your shit doesn't stink, you think you put your money and it's gonna.
What drew you to a hair salon then?
It was franchising, so I knew the model, and it was a new brand moving into the Australian market. So we were getting early and cheaper than everybody else would have. So we took an opportunity. We opened 2 salons. It didn't end up working out, you know, and I moved on. But, you know, there's $750,000 just gone there. You know what I mean?
In retrospect, what's the mistake that you made because you thought that everything you touch was going to turn to gold?
There is one common thread across every business that I launched except this last one. And that is when I launched the Poker League, it was a great success, but it was not on the back of what we were doing. It was actually on the back of what the pubs and clubs were doing. So if I can explain that, they were, if you go to a local pub and you see a poster for a poker game on Thursday night, you're going to come back. There's no amount of Google searches or paid ads that I can run to drive you into a pub. But if you're going to your local anyway, and on Thursday nights there's a poker game, I'm going to come back. So marketing is the common thread that I didn't ever learn in business. I never had to learn it in poker because it was done by the venues. The franchise salons, you think you open the doors and people are going to come in, so there's no marketing. So I never did any understanding of the power of marketing to actually launch a product. You can have the best product in the world. This is my lesson. You can have the best product in the world. If nobody knows it exists, it doesn't matter. So that's the common thread amongst the businesses that I lost all this money because I never did adequate marketing. I didn't know how to do it. It wasn't a skill set that I had.
In retrospect, the marketing for poker was brilliant that you didn't have to do it. It was built into the product itself. Right.
Correct.
Okay. All right. And so did you get to a point where you said, I can't do this anymore? I'm failing.
No.
Doubt yourself. None of that.
No. As I mentioned to you pre-interview, I don't know how to lose. I'm a sore loser and I'm not a
quitter. I get it, but you never even thought of yourself as a loser? You didn't think you failed? You didn't go through mental, like...
Oh, absolutely.
But what happened to you? I
toughed it out. So the first thing that I have to say is the biggest failure for me in life, and this is by far, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs feel this way, but for me personally, is working for somebody else.
Okay.
I could have easily, after the success that I had in that poker league, I could have easily gotten CEO jobs in any company because I had achieved something amazing in a very short period of time. So I would have gotten jobs, well-paid jobs. But remembering back to that job that I was working for that bank was the turnoff that I will never work for anybody else, especially once you've tasted success working for yourself.
Right.
So for me, I could not give up the idea of me continuing to push and drive and try to build something of my own over working for somebody else and giving them the reward of my experience. So that was kind of the thing that held me back from giving up and just saying, okay, enough is enough. I've lost it all. And as I said to you in the email that when I contacted you, not only did I lose all my money, I had to maintain a lifestyle that was pretty high. I then went on to sell my house. I wanted to actually relocate to move to Canada. I ended up getting rejected, so we ended up back in Australia. I ended up going so negative that I ended up cashing in my 401k in Australia, or the version of 401k, which is our super, to survive. And at the end of that, I was able to lift off and get back. So I wasn't negative again. It was minus 40 when I started the poker league. It was probably minus 200k.
Wow.
So yeah, I went through the ringer.
Feel defeated at that point is shocking.
Well, I mean, it's either naivety, stupidity, or just pure fight. I don't know which one of those it is, but I knew, and I have to say this, the most amazing thing is that my wife was there through it all and
stuck with you,
and believed in me through it all. I have to give credit to her over anybody else because to have lived with me, to have seen what was going on and the bank account going negative, 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 negative every month, it was something that, you know, I will thank her for the rest of my life.
What about this? I remember when things were going bad for me financially with the business, I felt that I didn't have any energy. I didn't have the confidence. I wasn't communicating in sales as well. And then it wasn't until I discovered running where I could master something, where I could do really well in the morning before getting into work. And so I felt strong that I had the confidence to get back in it. Did you have something like that? Some external thing that gave you confidence? No.
Now that you posed the question, I don't think I had anything. It was more about one of the things that there, self-awareness is probably one of the biggest skills that I've learned throughout this entire process. And one of the things that I've learned is that I'm a problem solver. And I think most entrepreneurs are that and nothing else. And I heard recently a quote saying, founders are builders, CEOs are people that scale businesses. And I'm very much that builder. So for me, I love getting in the mud and building things and kind of working things, problems out and this and that. And when the problems disappear, I get turned off. So for me, the fact that I had this problem actually drove me. Okay. Because I needed to find a solution no matter what. It was kind of the driving force was actually the problem itself.
So I don't want to spend too much time on theboardroom.com only because I want to get to Alfred, but you came up with theboardroom.com how?
Well, fortunately, because of my success with the Poker League, I had lots of friends who were CEOs of companies and, you know, successful entrepreneurs. So I actually got recruited to be a chairman at the CEO Institute in Australia. And I became at the time the youngest chairman in the history of the program. And effectively, it's just a mastermind group, just to put it into simple terms. But the business model is that they're selling me as the chairman to host these meetings with these groups. And they were paying me an hourly fee, a nice hourly fee, but an hourly fee nevertheless. And they were selling memberships with my name on it for 10, 15 grand a year. Yeah. So I thought, this doesn't work for me either. So once I learned the model of masterminds and how they worked, I flipped the business model on its head. And I said, in order to appeal to really top CEOs or retired CEOs or people with skill, you got to give them a good pay. And what I did is I flipped the model where I'm paying them 80% of the mastermind revenue and I would keep 20%.
Got it.
So I was able to go to my network and say, hey, I'm launching the Boardroom. It's a virtual and in-person mastermind meeting group that we do monthly. We're going to charge this and you're going to get 80% of that. And obviously they would have said yes, because who wouldn't?
But again, you're selling and they get to keep the vast majority of the revenue, of course.
Correct. Correct. The problem with that business is two things. One was that although they're great at what they do, CEOs in their own fields and whatever, they're not great at sales. So if I set up a meeting with someone to actually, you have to meet the person you're going to be doing the mastermind with. Right. If you met with them, they wouldn't know how to sell themselves. So then the sales rate wasn't good, even though the caliber of people was incredible. So that was one of the problems. And the second problem is that the marketing sucked. Again, it was just another thing that I didn't know how to do. So I put go ahead.
But because the marketing sucked, it seems from what you've told me before, that's what led to Alfred. You said, correct, I need to come up with a system, something that will get people to come in. And so what did you come up with? What's the first
version? I did paid advertising. I did everything but TV and radio. I put money on everything and nothing really worked. But I got in touch with a friend of mine who runs a LinkedIn agency, and he said, why don't you try LinkedIn? Uh-huh. Cut a long story short, this guy is the only time that I was successful in marketing, because I was able to take someone's profile, a major CEO, connect them with the target audience, and get them meetings on the fly without leaving my home. And it worked so fantastically that we actually hired virtual assistants to run their campaigns for them. But I couldn't scale it.
How did it work? What was it that it did for LinkedIn? Right. What's the process
so
that you assisted?
We had 15 consultants, 15 CEOs in our masterminds, okay, that we were marketing. We would take over their LinkedIn profile. We would beef it up, make it look better. And then they sold themselves. Their conversion rate was 60, 70%. Because if you get the CEO of Verizon, for example, contacting you, you're going to accept.
Okay.
Same thing, but in the Australian context, right? Okay. So we would connect them with target people. And then we say, hey, you know, we're running a mastermind. Would you like to have a meeting to discuss it? And then they would have a meeting and then they would sell.
Find people who would be in the target, send them a message from that person's LinkedIn account. God, I think you had the president of Warner or the former president of Warner Music, for example, right?
Correct.
Got it. So it would be you that take over the that level. You would take over their LinkedIn accounts and correct, you would have an assistant send messages from their LinkedIn account saying, correct, I'm hosting. Who would say no to that? Got it. And so this was good, but it wouldn't scale. How? What was the problem with scaling?
Well, it doesn't seem like it needs to scale. The virtual assistants to do it manually would take the best part of 3 hours. When you have 15 people, I needed to scale the team. It wasn't easy, right? So then I looked at software to automate it, and I didn't like the tools that existed in the market. So I then looked at building something, and I connected with someone on Upwork, and they, you know,
and that's you said, what did you tell them that you wanted it to do?
originally what we wanted to do is just to view profiles automatically. There was a product, I can't remember what it was called, it was $99 a month. And I said, how expensive can this be to just view someone's profile automatically? I contacted someone on Upwork, and he had just built that product for someone else who didn't pay them and sold it to me for $250. So okay. I said, okay, here we go, $250. I'll roll it out. And when you got the CEO of a major company looking at your profile and you get a notification, you think, hey, why is he looking at me? So you're getting the reverse engineered outreach by saying they're contacting you.
But all it would do is it would just go look at people's profiles so that they got, when they went to LinkedIn, would see that somebody looked at their profile. Correct. And then would it, I guess, based on some kind of targeting, you would say who you wanted, yeah, and then it would go and look at
searches and stuff like that. Yeah.
And what would somebody do? If I saw that someone looked at my profile, I don't know that I would do anything about it. What did they do about it?
They would receive connection requests.
Oh, it would look
but
at their
now
profile.
The sales discussion changed.
Oh, so when your target.
Not reaching anymore. They're trying to reach you.
Sorry. We're talking over each other because of the connection. What you're saying is when your target would see that a major CEO was looking at their profile, they would just send them a connection request.
Correct.
And then that allowed you to go and, or your virtual assistants to go and send a message out on their behalf. Got it.
The sales discussion changes, right? Because if you're contacting me, you're approaching me, not me approaching you.
Right.
So it was very powerful. But then that was stage one, like the first version. And then we added connection requests, and then we added messages, and we added this.
Meaning where it would automatically send a connection request on behalf of your clients. Got it. And at what point did you say, you know what? I got software here that's so powerful. This should be the business.
I'd never thought of that, to be honest. I fell into this. So what had happened was that I had run the boardroom for the best part of 2 years. It was semi-successful. It wasn't huge. It was paying the bills. So I wasn't going into negative anymore at that point, but I wasn't going into positive either. It was just survival. So then what happened was that I decided with my partner, we had launched two pieces of technology. One is a virtual conferencing platform like we're talking here in Zoom, but it's web-based. So there was no downloads, no nothing. It was part of the boardroom.com, and that's how we met with clients. And the other was this LinkedIn automation software. So what we did is we said, let's just push it out there, see if people would actually use it. And we published it on the Chrome store, the Google Chrome store, and we left it there. We no support or nothing. We're using it ourselves. We also told our clients they could use it. Here it is, blah, blah, blah. And we did that in November 2017. February 2018, we had 6,000 users. Just like that.
They
loved it. For free.
At you weren't charging in the Chrome store at that point. Okay.
I was not charging at the time, but it was a pretty basic product.
Okay.
So we turned on payments in March 2018.
Okay.
And we didn't convert 6,000 customers, but we converted a lot. So that became, you know, high margin business with no operational cost.
Right.
And we said, okay, let's look into this a bit more. We then kept on growing. We got approached by AppSumo to run a deal. We had already by then had thousands upon thousands of subscribers. We ran a deal with AppSumo. We became at the time the third or fourth largest deal that they had ever been done at the time. And then it just took off. So we went from 14,000 users. And it just grew from there pretty rapidly.
I am looking up I can't stop looking this stuff up. The nice thing about AppSumo is it looks like they even did a YouTube video on you guys. And so that's still out there bringing people in. It's that even after the deal, because they give an unbelievably low deal for lifetime access, right?
Correct.
I think is what
Correct.
You did. But even after the deal is closed, their SEO is still so good that it still sends people traffic from what I understand, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so now you're on track. How do you know what to do to improve to it? What was your process for figuring out the next features?
Well, I'm a user. I'm a user of the product. So I knew what people wanted because I've been using it all along. So I kept on building what I needed. And I also listened to customers' needs and whatnot. They said, can you build these? Can you build that? And whatnot. So it was just really, again, me building my own product and scratching my own itch. That was it. But then it just became bigger and bigger, and effectively we became the third largest tool in the marketplace within like 6 months. It was just super fast. Again, it took off like the poker league.
So I get now how this is working. What about marketing? Did you eventually? There's still no, you're still not good at marketing. The only thing you're doing is putting it in the Chrome store and letting people try it. And then at some point when you charged, it was freemium, where there was a portion that was free and then another part that wasn't.
What happens with the Chrome store is that, you know, it was so well received. The product sold itself, but people review it. And based on your reviews and rankings, you appear higher on the search results. It's like Google.
Okay.
So we were getting a lot of free traffic, maybe 100, 150 new users a day from the Chrome store.
Right.
But just word of mouth. People saying, I'm using this tool. It's free. There's a free version, blah, blah, blah. So that's how it took off. It was really word of mouth. And around that time, but maybe a little earlier, is when I actually wrote the book, Freakonomics. Freakonomics, not Freakonomics, which is the best-selling book. It was Freakonomics. Yeah. You can download it for free. And basically, I pretty much tell the story of all of the freemium business models that I've learned over time, which was the free poker league, and now the freemium with the software. So I applied freemium as my business model pretty much throughout every business that I've done, but now in particular with this software.
It was called Leonard. Well, we'll get into why it's now called Alfred. But when it was called Leonard, what was free about it and what was paid? Where did you draw the line?
So we had a free trial, unrestricted free trial. And the benefit of a Chrome extension is that you can see LinkedIn, the stuff happening on LinkedIn right in front of you. So you see the connection requests being sent and so on. So people, they're just mesmerized. They're sitting there looking at this bot just doing all this work. So they use it for free for 14 days, unrestricted. And then they could choose a free plan if they chose to. We were the only product in the market that had a free plan. So we would get a lot of free users who would then choose to upgrade because they wanted access to the other features.
Got it. All right. What happened to the name? It's now called Alfred. It used to be called Leonard.
Right. So Chrome extensions, unfortunately, LinkedIn doesn't like any LinkedIn automation. They don't like it. I mean, if I get into the real story, to me, they're like, it's their playground with their rules, with their ball. You do what they say or you don't do it at all. Same with Facebook, same with Twitter, same with everybody else. So they don't give API access, so you kind of have to hack your way in. But when you do it as a Chrome extension, there are ways that they can detect what you've installed. So what they do is they, once they figure out how to detect it, because we obviously try to not detect it, once they figure one way, they flag a lot of people, but they don't restrict you, they don't do anything. They just flag. Then later on, whenever they decide, they go, boom, all of these people are going to get a warning. You either uninstall this or you're going to lose your account, which they never do. It's just a threat. But that's what they, I mean,
I wouldn't want to risk it. Got it. And so now all these people are freaking out because, and they did LinkedIn tell those people, your users, that it's because of Leonard? They did.
Correct. They even say the name. So they know, and it wasn't just us. Many, many Chrome extensions got you know, detected that way. So then what we decided was, you know, we needed to move away from a Chrome extension. And we also wanted to build some other capabilities that we couldn't do with a Chrome extension. So we actually approached another company and cut a long story short, they actually got threatened by LinkedIn just as like every other tool, but they're based in San Francisco. So we acquired them and acquired their technology. And that's when we launched Alfred. So Alfred is a desktop app and Leonard was a Chrome extension. And we were running them concurrently for a period of time. So they were two separate brands. But what we then decided is that this Chrome extension thing detection is just not for us. Every time you get detected, you lose 40% of your business. So we said, let's transition from one platform to the other. And let's leave the Leonard brand behind and leave the people that have had a sour taste in their mouth behind and move to this technology that they can't detect at all.
And so the reason that you could survive as a desktop app is because they can't detect it. What you're doing is you're just mimicking a user on their own computer with their own IP, I bet at some point they can detect it, but it's much, much harder.
They haven't detected it yet. They're not that they haven't tried. They have tried, but the way they make, I mean, I won't get you into the technical details, but it is undetectable compared to anything else. The only things that can happen is that they detect unusual activity. So let's say you have a LinkedIn basic account. You go from there to sending 100 connection requests a day, every day. They're going to say, wait, hang on, you know, there's something's odd here. And then they assume that there is automation. So they may give you a warning, but they can't say it's Alfred. They can't say it's whatever tool. They just know that it's unusual activity.
Right. I think they could, they could detect that there's automation, but they can't detect what that automation. Well, I bet that they could still do that.
And there's nothing for you to say, hey, I'm sending 100 connection requests manually every day. They can't say that because the way our product works is it mimics human behavior. So we don't send 100 connection requests only in one go. We send a few. We take a coffee break. We send another few. We send another coffee break.
Like someone who's a hustler who's willing to sit down and put in the work. You mimic that. Okay. Exactly. All right. By the way, it's Alfred, but I should say to anyone who's listening who wants to go check out the software, you should go to meetalfred.com. I kind of feel like you should change the name of the company to Meet Alfred. If we're going to talk about it, we should be giving the URL as much as possible. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people call us Meet Alfred. I don't know why. What we wanted to do is one of the things that we did that worked really well with Leonard and now with Alfred is that we differentiated by giving the product a personality. People call us or people contact us and they say, hey, Alfred, how you doing? Like,
okay, it is more elegant to just have the name Alfred. All right, what about this then? You now no longer have the Google store, the Chrome store promoting you. What do you do now to promote yourself? How does a guy who doesn't know how to promote himself, who failed because he was challenged by that, how does he promote this new business?
There is a thing to be said about being a perfectionist and building a great product. And the product promotes itself. So we've grown to over 40,000 registered users because people are spreading the word about the product and the quality of the product. Now, like with every product, every software product, there's bugs from time to time, especially when you're dealing with LinkedIn, who changes their algorithms and code all the time. But it's the most stable product. It is reliable. People are very happy with it. So they're willing to spread the word. The only thing that we've done to market this product to date has been the introduction of what's called a Refer a Friend program, where you, as a subscriber, refer someone and get $10 off if they subscribe, and your friend also gets $10 off. So there's a lot of that going on because a lot of people, effectively, if you refer enough people, you get the product for free, you know, so depending on what plan you're on. So that has been a stroke of genius with regards to the product and how we design it and that it sells itself. We are now entering the world of marketing as we speak. I just hired the head of growth, a gentleman out of Israel who's an expert in this and actually comes from a competitor. And we are now, for the first time after 3 years and a bit, going to invest in marketing. We're going to start with webinars and partnerships and educating people on LinkedIn, building a lot of content. We've done nothing, no content ever.
No,
I don't even do emails.
You stink so badly at it, Martin, that SimilarWeb is not showing much traffic for you. I go to look you up on platforms like, these review sites like here, GT.com. I don't use it, but I know bigger businesses use it. They're just linking to what they think are your competitors because you're not even listed in there. The one place where I saw that you were listed and it looked like for a while maybe you were driving some customers to it was Trustpilot.
But you're not putting much work into it.
Just enough.
This is a true testament to product-led marketing, right? I'm not an expert at it, by the way, by any means, but it is the product and the quality of the product and its capabilities that's driven the growth. It hasn't been me, but I drive the product development as far as what I want to be built. So that's worked for us.
And before we started, actually, I think in email, you gave me your revenue. Are you comfortable sharing it publicly?
As I mentioned there, it's a private business. I own the majority of this business. So I'm going to give you a range just to fulfill your requirements of sharing revenues. We're doing more than 2 million and less than 5 million in revenues.
It's phenomenal, dude. And who owns the rest of the business?
The CFO of the company that acquired us and got fired.
Of the company that acquired which company?
The company that acquired the Poker League.
How did he end up owning a piece of the business?
Correct.
How?
He owns 20% of the business because I just befriended him. Like the whole reason why I had sold at the time is so I could learn from people with experience. So I built great friendships with both the CEO and CFO. The CEO now runs the largest TV network and cable television in the Middle East. So I don't get to see him very often, but I've befriended
him. Did he invest in the business?
No.
You just gave him 20% because you wanted his feedback. Like
I just trust him as an advisor.
Did it help?
It's been very good to me. Oh yeah. Invaluable.
Wow. Yeah. Your marketing sucks, dude. I can't believe you've gone so far.
Well, if we talk in 12 months, hopefully it'll change. But you know, we're still getting about 1,500 plus new trial users every month. We convert healthily at about 20, 25% of them into paying customers. The product just does a wonderful job.
Yeah, I feel like content would be really big for you. I put you into SEMrush.
You're not going to find anything.
No.
There's nothing.
There's nothing. There's
like product and customer service. We provide 24/7 customer support, which none of the other competitors do. And the products, and that's it. And you know, we I'm a nice guy, so if you hear from me or you get an email from me, it's, you know, hopefully you'll resonate to Martin sending
you. You're not still
email.
Doing your own customer service, are you?
No. I've got a very.
But you're saying if somebody hears from you, yeah. Look at this. You guys have a Windows app?
Yeah, it's Windows or Mac.
Windows or Mac, okay. Yeah, so I see that there's people searching to see if there's a Windows Oh, I see what it is. They are, you know, there's an Alfred search bar that you could connect to the Mac, and people are asking about that. That is people confusing you with that. Alfred is sending you more traffic than people intelligently, like, and you're still growing.
Yeah. It wasn't done, you know, on purpose. I didn't know there was another Alfred app.
No, there are a bunch of different companies called Alfred. The reason is that I think Alfred must have been some kind of butler in an old TV show, or maybe it conjures up this sense.
Batman's butler.
That's apparently what it is. Yeah. So it conjures up this sense of I'm going to go do the work for you. And so it fits really nicely.
But then again, that's how bad I am. I never even thought of that. People told me that after I bought the domain.
You just went with it. Your design is really nice. I remember you, didn't you show me your app a while back? I was doing a webinar for myself. I was curious about your software. You just did a screen share back when it was Leonard. You walked me through. It works beautifully. It's just simple. It's, and I could see why people use it.
But the thing is, I'm not a techie, right? So I want a product that's easy for me to use. So I try to make it easy for the users, because people don't have time to learn on these products, you know, all the time. You just want the damn thing to work.
It also just, I feel like you also got a nice designer, which is helpful. All right. For anyone who wants to go try it, it's Meet Alfred. Do you have a discount code or something, or code that people can use? I don't want to get a commission from it, but I'd love for you to see people coming in.
I'll give everybody my email, martin@meetalfred.com.
Wait, sorry, do it again. I just talked over you. Give me the email again. I talked over you.
It's martin@meetalfred.com.
Okay. And you just hook them up.
Just reach out to me personally and I'll look after you, because we don't have discount codes, because we already have discounts on the site plus the refer frame program. So we're working on a few other things that I'm happy to do individually to all your listeners.
This is just, and I don't think we've done enough to talk about what it does, right? I could email all the people in my, well, you talk about it. What does Alfred do?
Anything you do manually on LinkedIn, you can do with Alfred.
You can
connect with people. You can send them follow-ups. You can continue to send follow-ups if they don't respond. If they do respond, depending on how they respond, you can send them back into your sequence. You can start your conversations on LinkedIn and then move them to email. You can now, as of hopefully tomorrow, you can do it in Twitter as well. We are trying to build the leading, what's now called, social selling platform, which is... it's not well defined, this terminology of social selling, but it's all about multi-touch relationship building, automation that you can do in multiple different networks. So LinkedIn, email, Twitter, you know, and others. That's what it basically, it saves you a ton of time. I mean, I can tell you from personally doing it myself, it saved me at least 3 hours a day of manual process.
Do you have a use case or example of what somebody has done with Alfred? A case study, a story.
We don't talk about too many use cases because LinkedIn would potentially block their accounts if they know they're using automation. But we have many large companies and sales teams who use it to run their entire outreach campaigns. It's really designed for that.
Dude, I'm not going to call them out because I love the company and I don't want them to get hurt. You got from one of the major companies that I've interviewed. I shouldn't say major, like I don't want to talk about like their SAP, but a big company, good funding, good reputation. They gave you a quote here about how they're using Alfred, which makes me wonder, they're making a mistake. They should just keep that as their own little secret. What do they need to give you a quote for?
We try to change names where possible and whatnot. We try to keep the message, you know, the testimonial correct, but we try to keep everybody's privacy as much as possible.
All right. For anyone who wants to go try it, again, I do not accept commissions from my guests. I'm only just saying because I've seen this product evolve and I Martin, I've grown to really like you a lot, and I hope that my people go and try it. If you guys are out there and you do try Alfred, my email address is available to you too. I'd like to find out from you what you think of it. So my email address is andrew@mixergy.com. And frankly, most founders have first name at companyname.com. Let me know what you think of Alfred. And I want to thank my two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you're trying to systemize your business, make sure that everybody on your team is working like the best person on your team. There's a software called Trainual. They'll help you create the online manual for your team so that they all work together at their best. And if you go to trainual.com/mixergy, you will get to get a big discount on their software. And you already know by now, if you've got an idea the way that Martin has and you want to develop it, you need a good developer. I mean, really the best of the best. Bring them your biggest challenges. I dare you. And then challenge them to get you a developer who can solve them. Martin, keep that in the back of your mind. Go to toptal.com/mixergy. You have a big crisis, big issue. You have big need. Challenge them to find the best of the best people to solve it for you. And when you go to toptal.com/mixergy, they will give you 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no risk trial period. I'm doing a whole other ad for them now. I should instead say thank you, TopTal. Thank you, Martin. Bye, everyone.